Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
The Cinema Specialists are back, and John and I are here to talk about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 and discuss a really, really, really wild movie in Long Legs, the new horror movie that's kind of taken people by storm a little bit. Nicolas Cage is awesome. Can't wait to talk all about him. But it really is one of those movies that did really well this weekend, $22.4 million for an R-rated horror film, and its opening weekend, not on any type of special weekend, and especially just kind of in the middle of the summer. I feel like that's a really solid start for Long Legs. So, and I can say I actually enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. So guess what? We actually have a podcast worth talking about tonight, John.
I know. We got to be positive about two movies, and it's been a while since we've had that luxury, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be fun. I'm excited to do this. So I want to see what the Long Legs budget was before we under $10 million, and it made $22.4 in its open weekend. So this has been a success. I think we talk about Long Legs first. I think we get that, kind of going. And then we are, for scheduling updates for people who listen to us weekly, every week, you know, that fun stuff, what weekly means. I don't think we're actually going to be able to do a Twisters podcast next week. We were supposed to do the Marvels and Twisters next Sunday or Monday. I'm not going to be able to get to a movie theater until closer to July 26th. At that point, we've already missed our window, so we might as well just go ahead and we might as well just go right into Deadpool and Wolverine. So I actually think we're going to do Deadpool and Wolverine, and we are going to do the Marvels as one episode, and that's going to be our final episode in this Marvel series. We're not going to get into those. Maybe for patrons, we'll be able to do a Twisters episode, and maybe we'll actually get to the two Deadpool movies as well. We could do those as patron movies, but that wouldn't be till later in August. So if you're just dying to hear us talk about Twisters and all that, it's likely not going to come till a little bit later, which is funny because we recorded our Twister podcast and talked about how we definitely talked about Twisters already. But I just can't make it happen. There's no way I can make it happen. I really wish I could, but it's just not possible. Anywho, here we are. Let's talk about Long Legs.
Yes, let's.
I really, really like this. Mm-hmm. The ending left something to be desired, and I will talk about that when we get there. But the feel of this movie was just something else. This really was. There was just such an awesome feel to this movie from start to finish, and the sense of dread was just there the entire time. I gave it 3.5 stars. I really, really enjoyed it. Where'd you go with this, Sean?
I also ended up giving it 3.5 stars. It didn't quite do enough to get it over into that 4-star threshold for me. but this was everything I could have asked for. Oz Perkins' previous film, The Black Was Good Daughter, was like pretty mediocre to me. So I was a little tentative going into this. Quite impressed. The performances in this movie were spectacular. The atmosphere that Oz Perkins is able to capture throughout this film is so tense, and it is so unsettling that it just, you feel it the entire time. Even when nothing's really happening, there's always this potential that something can happen. And I think that's what makes a great horror film.
Yeah. Also, what's really been working in the favor of some of these slow burn horror directors is how much other directors have overused the jump scare. To the point where your anticipation, we have been so trained as audiences for a jump scare to happen at every moment that it's possible. Because we've talked about a lot of horror movies on this podcast, and that's just what horror movies do nowadays. We talked about The Nun 2 a long time ago. That was miserable. And the thing is, that really is what happens now. Horror movies love to just, here's a jump scare, let's do it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go for the cheap scare, not the real scare. And the classics, the ones that have stood the test of time, they might have a jump scare in them, but a lot of them are grounded in some form of reality or some form of this could happen to you. And they feed on a very particular fear. A movie like The Exorcist is like that. You don't have to be very religious to find that movie absolutely terrifying because it's a psychological horror movie. Mm-hmm. And Long Legs is that psychological horror movie. And it's able to subvert your expectations, because what you are thinking is going to happen because you've been trained to think that way doesn't happen, but it creates this sense of dread throughout. I think there's two jump scares in the entire movie, and they're not even really that big of jump scares. They're just loud noises. It's when she opens up the letter and puts it down and like slams it down to keep it flat. And then I think the opening of the movie has the jump scare. But even that, I can't classify that as a jump scare when Nicolas Cage drops his face down, because we know that she's talking to Long Legs for that entire scene. So when his face finally drops down, it's just that sense of dread the entire time. The atmosphere in this movie is incredible. And I love, absolutely love, like the set design and the artwork and all that stuff. I love the lighting. I love what they were able to do with this. That demon child that we keep seeing over and over again, who's beneath the black with the eyes still poking out, that's going to become iconic for horror movies. And it did it right. This is a horror movie that does it right. And we'll talk about the one thing I didn't like when we get there.
Yeah, this movie really takes this idea. That's like, it's a pretty tired concept, I think, when we get down to it, but it is able to present it in a very clever way. And I think it really sets the tone immediately when we get that different, when we get the 4:3 aspect ratio at the beginning of this film. It was at that moment where I was like, I'm bought into this movie already. And it's just because it's using a different aspect ratio. And I was almost sad when it turned out that was just the aspect ratio for these flashbacks. But the fact that it did keep coming back, it really set the tone for how this film was going to feel.
Yeah, and so it was a good way of just it's unsettling. And that's where sometimes you see these more artsy decisions in movies where people will say, oh, that was unnecessary. Why did they do that? It wasn't that great. But in this, it really was to unsettle you, almost like you're watching an old school horror, like a home video almost of the killing that's going to happen. We talk about how well that works in Sinister. When we see the home videos. So it's just about keeping you a little off kilter. And we see this used again later on in the movie when she wakes up from the nightmare. It starts off like that, and then it gets bigger, bigger, bigger. I think this is a great cold open. I will say that I really do enjoy these types of horror procedural movies. And I'm talking like Seven, The Silence of the Lambs. When these are done right, they can be so good. You have bad ones like The Bone Collector and things like that, which The Bone Collector is barely even a horror movie. But you have bad ones in there for sure that don't work, where the cops doing whatever. But when you get into the horrors of real people and you can turn that into a horror movie without it really being a horror movie, this movie's really not a horror movie. The only thing that makes it a horror movie is that it's a serial killer. Well, it's a serial killer. And it's demonic possession.
Right.
But at the end of the day, or not demonic possession, but you know what I mean. Like, it's
demonic kind of influence of sorts, yeah.
Yeah, influence, whatever. It's very Hail Satan. So my thing with this movie is it does tell you a pretty straightforward story early on. And that is refreshing when it comes to these kinds of movies, because like you said, it can be a tired concept, but sometimes the scariest things in the world are things that could really happen. And for the first hour and 20 minutes of this movie, I said to myself, this is terrifying because it's something that's real. This could be happening in anywhere in Oregon. And the fact that this movie's set in the 90s before a lot of, you know, technology had advanced to a point where you could really be checking up all the time. There's a reason that this is set very close to when Silence of the Lambs is set, because they want that feeling of, you know, that there's really not much that can be done and you actually can be isolated. So yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. I enjoyed the realism of it. And that's where it's like, it's a horror movie, but is it a horror movie? And yes, this is a horror movie, but I'm just saying, like, from the standpoint of, it's not like you have a monster, you have a serial killer. And it's not a slasher movie, because you don't really see a lot of the stabbings and things like that. Like, a lot of times that's what you'll see in a slasher movie. And this doesn't really have that.
I don't think we see any.
No, I don't think there's any murders that take place in this movie until the very
end. One at the very end, and that's it?
Yeah, until the very end. It's all in the last 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's all in the last 20 minutes. Everything else is being talked about. So it's a horror, but it's not the horror that you're used to. And I think that was really, really refreshing for me. And I love how they keep Nicolas Cage off screen as much as possible. I mean, this is a movie, look, it has Karen Shipka, who's amazing. If you haven't seen her in Mad Men, obviously she's amazing in that. And I know she's Sabrina the Teenage Witch, so that helps too. But Karen Shipka is incredible. She's barely in the movie. She's in one scene, but she is so damn good in that scene. And then you have Micah Monroe, who is phenomenal. She's in It Follows, and she's a 10 out of 10 in It Follows, and she's a 10 out of 10 in this. She gets how to do slow burn horror. But still, they're relying on the name of Nicolas Cage to put people in the theater for this movie. And I personally think this is probably the third best Nicolas Cage performance of his career.
Wow.
And it's a performance that is so hitting. And they could have gotten so much more out of it, but to show that kind of restraint, like, good for Oz Perkins for knowing that the fear is in the unknown and kind of taking a note out of the Silence of the Lambs book, where he is present in the entire movie without being present for the entire movie.
Yeah, he's really felt. And it's very interesting because I saw this movie with a friend and they said it felt like Nick Cage was just like, on that edge of like over the top, but I think it's really important for his character in this movie to be on that edge. I think like when you have Nicolas Cage in a movie, especially nowadays, you're kind of expecting hammy Nicolas Cage. Like, we're 30 years removed from like serious Nicolas Cage at this point. There has to be this level of ham because he has that physicality to him, and it makes it more unsettling, in my opinion, seeing him act in this way that is like understandable. You know, it's a good performance, but it's so weird. And it's just so abnormal from everything that's going on. That's what sets his performance apart here. And it's like you said, he's not in a lot of this movie. He's off stage or off screen a lot, where it's like, we're seeing like his lower half a lot, where we're seeing him in the distance and
back of his head.
Yeah. It works. And I think it really speaks to Nicolas Cage as a physical performer, which I think people often forget he is so capable of.
Well, and cause like I was saying after I saw it, I made the joke of like, honestly, it's like they couldn't get Mickey Rourke, so they put Nicolas Cage with really bad makeup. And not really bad makeup, but you know what I mean? Like bad makeup, as if Nicolas Cage as the character in this movie, long legs, doesn't know how to do his makeup and gets bad Botox. Not that the makeup in the movie is bad, because the makeup in the movie is terrifying. But at the end of the day, you're really just looking at a person. That's all you're looking at. Like, long legs is not anything more than a human who looks like he's had some really bad Botox and has weird hair and is a weird person. We hear the girl say in the one scene in the movie, like, dad, the weird guy's back again. He's weird. And yet it's still so believable because people like that do exist in the world. And Cage just captures it so well. And the movie does such a good job of making you unsettled where you're like, oh man, I'm going to be scared when I finally see this guy's face. And yeah, it's really creepy makeup, but at the end of the day, you realize it's just a person. Mm-hmm. It is just a person. But between the makeup and between Cage's performance, you're able to get so much more out of it. When you read that script, it's like, well, that's not that creepy. It's just a guy. But it's actually absolutely terrifying because the guy himself is so bizarre. The interrogation room scene might be the best acting Nicolas Cage has ever done. And that's why this, to me, is like the third best performance of his career, because that scene could be the best acting ever in the history of his career.
That's saying a lot. Nicolas Cage has some pretty stellar performances. Yeah. But it is one of those things where you're not sure how it's going to go. And that was what was so impressive about it, because I assume when you're talking about the interrogation scene, you're also talking about like the videotape that's seen beforehand of interrogation room, right?
The videotape is
that was unsettling beyond belief. Yeah. I don't know how Nicolas Cage does it. I don't think anyone knows how Nicolas Cage does it, but he is able to produce this character who you know isn't all there, but it seems so cognizant of everything he's saying at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And as that scene progresses in the interrogation room, it ultimately leads up to him smashing his face against the table.
Yeah.
It's that there's such a slow buildup in that scene that you're not sure what's going to happen. You're not sure if you are supposed to, you know, fear for the life of our protagonist at this point or like what's going on. And then just seeing Nicolas Cage go all out in this physical performance there, your response is just like, what just happened? You can't help but like have to take that moment to process it. And the movie gives you the time to process it as well.
Yeah. And everybody who's listening at this point knows that we will spoil throughout these podcasts and things like that. The fact that this is the first time you're really getting Nicolas Cage, like you're really getting long legs as a character, you're really getting a long performance from him. You feel like this is the turning point, right? This feels like mm-hmm. when Kevin Spacey shows up in Seven, even though we hadn't seen Kevin Spacey up to that point. That's what it feels like. It's like, okay, here comes John Doe. Here comes the character. Now we're going to start to see it. And for him to die in that scene is so unbelievably unexpected. And it's so good. And it really, really, really works. And you still get enough of Nicolas Cage because, again, then it starts after that is when it starts to get into the demonic elements of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Nicolas Cage and Longlegs is still radiating over the top of the movie for the remainder there. So, yeah, I was really, really into all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And now I need to address what I wasn't into. Okay. So, again, spoilers, here they come. The info dump at the end of this movie feels unbelievably out of place, in my opinion. Unbelievably out of
place. Like the mother's exposition?
The mother's voiceover feels so unbelievably out of place to me. I feel like what ended up happening was Oz Perkins made this movie. It gets so weird at the end. I still don't really understand the black smoke rising up from the doll's head. Like, I still don't really get that. But whatever, that's fine. That I think producers said, you need to explain this better. And there was really nowhere to put it to explain it. When she's whispering to the daughter in the bed, I'm okay with that. Okay, so she's whispering. That's great. Awesome. Yeah. Like, good for them. But the problem is, after that scene, after the that moment, the voiceover is no longer matching up with what she is saying to the daughter in the bed.
Mm-hmm.
So who is she talking to? Why is this being spewed to us? Where is this coming from? It's a character talking to the audience. It's not a character talking to another character or a character. And up until this point, there has been no inclination that this is anyone's story other than Micah Monroe's.
Yeah.
So how is she getting this information, and why should we be privy to it if she's not? And I can't really fault Perkins or the movie because I know that this is producer interference. I can feel the producer interference in my bones as I am watching this take place. But at the same time, it is kind of disappointing. And I didn't love it because also the thing was with all that voiceover, it still didn't clear everything up all that well for how the movie ended. Like, if you're going to do that, if you're going to overexpose, if you're going to dive in too hard, I feel like you have to go all in. And this movie doesn't go all into it. So it's like they give you so much information that feels out of place, but they still don't give you enough information to just tie it together with a bow. So why not just give us nothing or find a better way to include it? And that's my only complaint with the movie.
I think the big thing with that entire sequence is trying to demonstrate that the mother is doing this of her own volition. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that's a difficult thing to show, right?
Yeah.
How can you believe that? But I think the movie also sets it up that makes it difficult. I think there is a very good question in this movie of whether any of this actually happens.
Yeah.
There's a very, very good question.
Okay, there's definitely something mental going on with Micah Monroe, especially after we know that at the beginning of the movie, she's the girl who should have been killed by Longlegs and wasn't.
Yes, absolutely. But the thing is like there, because of the way that this mother character, like Ruth Harker's character, is set up throughout this entire movie. And the fact that, you know, that first phone call, she's like, do you continue to say your prayers? Like, have you said your prayers and everything like that? It's almost like the Carrie effect, right? Where we're shown the mother character who is just overtly religious. And how much does that actually impact our protagonist and their interpretation into things? There's a lot of moments like when the Longlegs letter shows up in Lee's house and all of a sudden she can like figure out how to decode it and stuff. And yes, I know there's a bit of a key, but it was like not a full key. And all of a sudden she can't, we don't see her decoding any of the letters. And obviously that's because movies don't want to show the boring stuff. But the question then becomes, and then everything's biblical verses and everything like that, right? Mm-hmm. The question is like, how much of this is actually inside Lee's head and how much of this is actually true and what's happening and not just like what Lee is seeing because of her upbringing.
Yeah. No, that's a good point because I do feel like there is something to be said for she really did lose it throughout most of her life. And there's clearly something wrong here and the man downstairs and all of that. Like, we don't know everything about her. We just know that once she gets involved, Longleg starts coming out a little bit more thoroughly.
Which is weird. And they admit, like, in the movie, it's weird that all of a sudden you're involved in this case and we just, like, opens wide up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I that, like I said, though, that's still the only thing. Like, I hear where you're coming from with that. Like, I think you could take it either way. I'll just take it at face value of this was a Silence of the Lambs type movie. And I think what disappointed me is I almost wanted it to stay in the real world. I almost didn't want it to go the religious way. And if it went the religious way, I think I wanted something like a little bit more because the religious stuff at this point doesn't scare me to the extent that Buffalo Bill scares me in the Silence of the Lambs.
Right. Because you're more scared of that human element of it all. And I think the interesting thing that Oz Perkins does do in this movie, Oz Perkins establishes a supernatural element incredibly early that is not talked about again throughout the entire movie, but it's just enough at the beginning of the movie to make this ending with the devil and everything completely believable. Mm-hmm. And that is when they're canvassing and she has like the psychic reading. It's just enough of this supernatural element to make everything that happens after it believable. Also, as soon as she rolls up into that like housing community, I'm like, I know where this was filmed. It very much, very clear became Vancouver because there are so many housing facilities that look exactly like that in Vancouver.
John.
Yes, Oregon. Wasn't Vancouver whatsoever.
Did you notice the background of the entire movie?
100%.
It's so good.
So good. So subtle. So
that was the best part of it, is how subtle it was. My wife didn't notice it the entire movie. She said she only noticed it at the end when it's on the bed. Yeah, because she's not looking for it. And the thing was, it was just dark enough that it almost just looks like a moving shadow.
Yeah.
And yet in almost every scene of this movie where there's a dark corner, there is a devil figure in the background. There is a devil figure in the shadow in every single scene in this movie where there's a dark corner. It happens so much, and they get more prominent and they go away. Then they get prominent and they go away. And it's that feeling of she's been being watched by the devil ever since she escaped him. Mm-hmm. She escaped the devil, and now she's being watched by the devil nonstop. It is so unbelievably creepy. And that's the type of shit I love. That's when horror movies are cooking at their finest. It follows where the villain doesn't move faster than a stroll the entire movie. It's one of the best horror movies to come out in the last 20 years because it knows what can unsettle you. What's the name of that guy who did the Nun video who makes fun of it?
I can't remember.
You sent me the video of like, this is everything wrong with horror movies. I forget what his name is, and I wish I'd give him the credit, but you know, he goes in on like, if you're not scared of a nun in makeup, then you're not scared of this. Everybody's scared of serial killers except for serial killers. Like, everybody's scared of serial
killers. It's cords. It's
cords. So, like, everybody is scared of serial killers. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes this unsettling. And honestly, everybody, and if you're not, you should be, everybody is scared of something in the background of your room just waiting to pop out and say, hey, how you doing?
Yes. Absolutely. 100%. It's like, I mean, anecdote from life. The other night, I forgot I opened my closet door before going into my bathroom and then got out of my bathroom. It's like, why is my closet door open?
So creepy, man. I hate that shit.
Yeah. It's one of those things that like we're just kind of programmed because of our imaginations, right? Our imaginations and us wanting to fill the void of darkness. And horror movies capitalize that. And Oz Perkins capitalizes on it beautifully. Also knowing that horror fans, people who seek out these movies and love these movies, are always looking in the dark corners.
Yeah. They're always going to look for that kind of stuff. Yep. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Overall, was close to perfect, but wasn't. I would love to see Nicolas Cage get some legitimate credit for this movie. Like, I'm talking like Oscar nom.
I don't think he will.
I don't think it'll happen because I don't think he's in enough of the movie.
I also don't think the Oscars like acknowledging horror movies still to this day.
They do a better job of it nowadays, though. And a name as big as Nicolas Cage's. I mean, this movie making as much money as it is, there's the potential for it because people are going to... Long Legs is going to be memed and Long Legs is going to be a thing. And remember, we saw this time last year, we saw Ryan Gosling catch on for Barbie.
That's true.
Same time last year for a comedy where they never give it to those types of comedies. And in a movie that was dominated by women and, you know, was a feminist movie, to have Ryan Gosling be remembered all those years, all those months later, Nicolas Cage could fall into that. Nicolas Cage isn't going to be, doesn't have as many bits throughout the movie, but just that scene of him in the car alone is terrifying enough that he should get the freaking nomination.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, absolutely. We haven't talked about Blair Underwood at all. How did you feel about him, his performance as the like hardened FBI agent?
I thought he was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I thought he was absolutely phenomenal. Yeah, I thought Blair Underwood was great. Perfect casting on that point. I thought Alicia Witt was great. Perfect casting on that point. Like, as far as I'm concerned, they really couldn't have done any better. Kieran Shipka does everything she can with her one moment. I think the leads in this movie, the ones who get any meat, they were all perfect. I was into every single one of them.
I agree. It was just a very well-made film. And I mean, we've talked about how much it made this weekend. This is Neon's biggest opening ever.
Really?
Ever. And Neon is starting to really pick up steam as a distribution company, as a production company. Mm-hmm. I believe, if I recall correctly, it's the last 5 Palme d'Or that they've picked up now.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're picking it up and like they're slowly moving into that same A24 category. And we're just not noticing it because we don't think about them that way.
Yeah.
This is huge. This is a big, it might not seem like it, but I think this is actually going to end up being a very big moment for cinema moving forward.
I hope so. Because I will say I'm so sick and tired of the Blumhouse. Here's your trailer where, oh my gosh, everything's so nice. This is great. Oh, wow. Look at us. Dark, brooding, misery. Like, I am so over that trailer. We saw 2 Blumhouse trailers. They were the exact same trailer. They're the exact, oh, look, light butterflies. Everything is bright and sunny. And oh my gosh, this is so nice. What's going to happen? Darkness, hell on earth. It's like, oh my God, get over yourselves. Like, absolutely get over yourselves. That's a company that's just,
yes,
I feel like they lost it, in my opinion. I got nothing left from them.
I was in part of your 40 minute trailers because I went to the States last weekend and learned that you guys have watched way too many trailers before your movie.
Dude, 35 minutes of trailers before this one. It's unbelievable. It just keeps getting worse. It used to be like 15 minutes, then it went up to 20, and I was like, whatever. Now you're getting ads in the middle of trailers. Like, it's insane. Oh, this last one, our movie was supposed to be 7:40. It literally didn't start till 8:15. I couldn't believe it.
Well, I mean, at least you up here, we have an ad for our city that plays before every movie now.
That's fine.
It's a take. I'll send that video to you later. It's something.
Yeah, I like that. All right, let's jump over to Guardians 3. Let's do that. Our last foray into probably good Marvel movies. Well, I mean, I'm sure Deadpool Wolverine
might be promising.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Finally, one that John admits is good because the Guardians movies are good. And now I can finally say that Guardians and Captain America work. Everything else really doesn't, but Guardians and Captain America work. I really enjoyed this movie. This was a good one. And now I actually haven't ranked it. I got to put this one in there. But anyway, let me get it in here. But yeah, I really liked this. I thought this was a solid movie. I was entertained. I think it gets unnecessarily dark at some points where it's like, why do you have to be so dark? But you know what? I appreciate the effort that went into this one. And yeah, I was into it. It's not on the level of Guardians 2. I think it's just below that. I'll put it as my eighth favorite, which means that Captain America, three Captain Americas, three Guardians of the Galaxies in my top eight movies from Marvel on this Marvel watch. So I have a taste, I guess you could say.
Well, it ended up sixth on my Marvel rankings.
Wow, look at you.
It might be too low. Honestly, I almost gave this movie 3.5 stars. I was really close
to 3.5 on this one. Yeah, very close.
I was very, very close. And I think like the more I sit with it, the more I'm going to appreciate this one. This was my second time watching it. I watched it when it was originally released and was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. There were elements of it that I didn't really like the first time I saw it. Primarily the stuff with like Peter and Gamora. Didn't really like that the first time I watched it. That
was my biggest complaint. Didn't love it. But anyway,
I appreciate it a lot more on a rewatch, which I didn't expect to have happen. But I mean, we can dive into that eventually. Do you remember that this movie almost didn't have James Gunn directing it?
I don't. Because I paid zero attention to these movies when they were coming out. Zero.
So when this movie was in production, it was when those old James Gunn tweets surfaced. And everyone was like, oh, we got to cancel James Gunn. And then Disney was like, okay, we're going to fire you. And then everyone's like, no, you're not. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. And the movie still got made.
I don't remember that at all. I don't even remember his tweets. I mean, this was recent. This movie came out last year.
Yeah, these were tweets from like 2012 that resurfaced or something during the production of this movie.
People are unreal, man.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. And this movie couldn't be made by anyone other than James Gunn. And it has that James Gunn consistency to it. The nice thing about having James Gunn direct all three of these movies is you see the through line. And what Volume 3 really gives us is a very good conclusion for this iteration of the Guardians.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I don't necessarily love that they all break off and go their own separate ways. I feel like that's kind of like a cheap cop-out because you know that eventually they're going to get back together in some way, shape, or form. But I do like that it does feel like the end of a trilogy, which, you know, some of these other Marvel movies aren't doing. I liked the background on Rocket. Like I said, I think it got a little unnecessarily dark at parts, but I felt like that created the human element to it. It really was the Gamora stuff. Like, for me, the biggest complaints I had were it was pretty damn long. It's a pretty damn long movie. And the Gamora stuff just didn't really hit for me. It was very okay at best. And I almost felt like there was something missing that explained why they were able to get in touch with this new Gamora so easily. And maybe that's just me not remembering, but like a little refresher on why they were able to get in touch with her so easily would have been nice for me, because the last thing I remember seeing is her get thrown off a cliff.
Oh, remember, you know, so she came back in Endgame. This Gamora came back in Endgame when Thanos came through, like through time and stuff. So yeah, I probably don't remember that Gamora, which is why this is, which is why I actually appreciated it a lot more this time, because the first time I watched it, Peter's being hung up on Gamora kind of bugged me. It's like, dude, get over it. Like, this is creepy. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very common way of reading this the first time. But I realized with the conclusion of this movie, it's how we get Peter at the end of this movie and where Peter is able to get at the end of this movie, because he has come to the realization that this isn't Gamora at that point. And it's not the same Gamora. And it's a little heavy-handed with the way Gamora, like, the way the character keeps saying, I'm not that Gamora, that's not me. Like, your memories are not.
Because I feel like, why would she say that? Right.
Well, we also have to remember this is pre-Guardians 1 Gamora. Right? This is Gamora from when she was still working for Thanos.
So yeah. So why would she even care about the Peter Quill? Like, why would she keep feeling the need to say, I'm not that Gamora? It's almost like she shouldn't even believe that there ever was another Gamora.
Yeah, but I think, like, she just had this connection because she's been in this universe. I'm a little iffy on, like, what the timeline is between Endgame and this, but it's been some time at that point, right? A couple of years. She's clearly still in communication with Nebula, so as her sister and everything. So it does kind of make sense, although not actually her sister because it's a different Nebula, but that's besides the point, I guess.
Again, keep going back to that stuff, yes.
Yeah. But it worked in the end because of where Peter gets at the end of this movie, where Peter, the entire purpose of him clinging on to the past is that he's using it to not go to his other past, where he gets to, like, the end, where he's like, I'm going to go visit my grandpa. You were also probably confused why Mantis was all of a sudden Peter's sister.
Yeah, I had no, honestly, I didn't even put that into my brain. I didn't even let it hit.
Prior to the release of this movie, there was a Christmas special that was released in which it is revealed Mantis is Peter's sister because she is Ego's daughter. And the entire premise...
Remind us of that?
The entire premise of that special is Mantis wants to make Peter happy and get him a Christmas present. So her and Drax go to Earth and kidnap Kevin Bacon.
Yes, I remember you talking about kidnapping Kevin Bacon.
Actual plot to a canonical Marvel story.
Yeah, I do remember you talking about that. Stupid that it's in the canon. I feel like Disney has learned from, like, with their TV shows and stuff. That was a failed experiment. Mm-hmm. They realized that, okay, movies have to be one thing and TV and stuff have to be another. They thought with doing Disney Plus that, like, they could be like, here's our series, here's our shorts, here's our movies, here's everything, and people will just gobble it all up. It's not happening for them by any stretch of the imagination. And so I'm glad that happened, because I like think I kind of heard them say that, and like I was just like, whatever, I don't care, doesn't matter to me, don't know how it works, I'm just gonna ignore it, because that just felt easier like for me than trying to figure it out. But all that being said, I do feel like this movie, because it doesn't harp on that relationship so much, I feel like I'm able to say, okay, that's fine. Like, whatever. Yeah. Didn't really take away from the movie because I don't really know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that's the only real plot in this thing. Like, the plot point that was discussed in any of these shows or anything like that. Uh-huh. Things get a little more confusing the further on we go from now on, but that's fine.
I did really like Will Poulter in this movie. I don't know if that's popular or not. I thought he was very funny in this movie. Even his introduction and then how he comes about throughout the rest of the movie. I thought he was like, it was some really nice levity with him. Mm-hmm. That worked, because this is definitely your Marvel type humor, which the Marvel type humor doesn't always work. But I feel like with that character, it just really did. And so I was very appreciative of that, especially since this movie definitely was lacking whatever the pirate guy's name is that you didn't like. And then
Yondu?
With his son, what was it?
Yondu?
Yeah, him. And then with Sean Gunn not being in as much of this movie, at least not until the end, like, it was nice to have that Will Poulter character kind of show up every now and then just to be the comedic relief and kind of realize that he's like not really as purposeful as he thought. I do enjoy that. So he worked, and then I felt like with this movie, the motivations might have been the clearest out of any Marvel movie we've watched thus far. They have to save Rocket's life. Great. Yep. I understand. Like, awesome.
Yeah, and they establish it quite early in a way where it doesn't seem forced, right? It's not one of those, oh, why has this not come up before? It's just like, hey, he hasn't been hurt enough that they've had to use a med pack, so it triggered this kill switch. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. It triggers the kill switch, and then now they need to save him. And it's funny because we're coming off of Quantumania, where in Quantumania we also see a very early inciting incident that totally doesn't work. That just feels nonsensical, and it leads to this whole storyline that doesn't even take place. Where I sit there and watch, why do I even care about this other than Kang the Destroyer coming in? And with Rocket, it was like, okay, I understand this is a character I care about. This is somebody that is part of the Guardians. Even if I know that ultimately he's going to be fine, let me watch this take place. And it leads to you get a side of Rocket that you're not used to seeing, which does actually elevate the movie. It elevates the story. It elevates the franchise, in my opinion. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that there was a really good inciting incident with this. You had Will Poulter. And honestly, like the other guy, the villain's idea of pretty much playing God and wanting to create a world of perfect beings, I didn't hate that either. I felt like that one actually was like, it made sense. And it kind of dives into the whole, like, you know, experimenting on animals so that we can save humans. He's doing the same thing, but it's to create a perfect society where there is no violence or whatever, but human elements start to come out of everything. Once you can think, you start to think of how can I get better? How can I get worse? Blah, blah, blah. And you see drug dealers doing whatever. And they talk about that in the movie, but trying to create this utopia, it's a plot that makes sense.
And it feels comic book, which I think we've been missing sometimes in our villains when it comes to the MCU, is this feels like a comic book, like, scheme, right?
Yeah.
And I think Chikwudi Awuji gives a phenomenal performance as the High Evolutionary. Mm-hmm. He is just intimidating enough, and you understand his purpose, you understand why this character's here, you understand what he's getting at. And you understand his motivations, like you said, right? Like, there's the motivation there, and it's present, and it maintains itself throughout the entire film to the point where we see the High Evolutionary becoming obsessed over those motivations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and it makes sense why he would do that. And then also for him to be attacked by his own creatures and, like, his own creations and whatever. And why are his creations becoming better than him, smarter than him, all of that? It's asking good questions, right? It's the whole Dr. Frankenstein of everything, of what have I done? Is this what I intended to do? Yeah, I think, again, like, I was very close to giving this 3.5. I really was. Even the fight scene at the end, it doesn't feel as bogged down as some of the other fight scenes that we see throughout the history of, like, Marvel movies where, you know, there's actually a purpose to why the fight scene is taking place. They're actually rescuing people we care about. It makes sense why they're doing the stuff that they're doing. It doesn't just feel forced for the sake of feeling forced. And that's good.
I got into that fight scene and I said, oh, here we go. Typical Marvel third act. But the actual fight scene of it doesn't last all that long, in all honesty. It's short, and then it goes into the escape of it all, which, I mean, you could classify as part of the escape or the fight scene, but it feels different. Like you said, it feels different than the usual MCU fare that we're used to in these third acts. And more importantly, it really gave us this beautiful conclusion to Drax.
Yeah, the Drax stuff was really solid. And, like, you were meant to be a father and all that. Like, and now he's with the kids and we see him actually speaking the kids' language and stuff like that. They gave human emotion to two of the characters that really didn't have depth prior to this. I always thought Drax was the best character just because he was funny, but he didn't have the depth that is had by these, you know, by the end of this movie.
No, I think you give Dave Bautista a little more to work with in this one, right? And
because Dave Bautista wanted to leave the franchise because he wants to be an actor. That's what he said. He said he's done doing Marvel because he wants to be an actor.
Mm-hmm. And, like, just the delivery of the line, you didn't ask.
Mm-hmm.
When he does speak the language to the kids, and Nebula's just like, what? You could talk to them the entire time. Why didn't you tell us? Like, mm-hmm. It's so simple because it really shows. And this is where I think this movie really exceeded. For two movies, I've been struggling to feel the found family of the Guardians of the Galaxy. The first mm-hmm. movie, they feel like this ragtag group. The second movie, they're kind of split up and they're pairing off. And that's more where the focus is. This was the first one that really, to me, felt like they were finally this found family that they've been saying they've been this entire time. Right?
Yeah.
We saw these connections and these relationships. We saw all these different relationships. I love the Drax and Mantis relationship is one of my favorites in the entire MCU, if I have to be mm-hmm. honest. The dynamic between Dave Bautista and Palm Clementif is mm-hmm. fantastic. Like, they really work well together, and they as the two, like, quote-unquote stupid characters in this movie, they bring a lot of the heart to this film.
Yeah.
And like, having Nebula there, who's, like, you know, we've seen go from enemy to family member, and always being angry and addressing the anger stuff of it all, it feels real. And then, like, even the concerns that everyone has over Rocket as he's injured, and, like, the desperation they have for saving him, and they're like, no, we have to do this no matter what. And even just the fact that, like, the entire opening conversation of this film is Peter is so drunk, how do we get him out of this funk? Like, it actually yeah. felt like these characters cared for each other.
Yeah, and I always felt, I always bought into it in the first three more, and maybe this isn't the worst. Maybe the first one's still the worst one out of the franchise. Maybe I should move this one up, but I had Black Panther Wakanda Forever below Guardians 1, and then I yeah. thought that Black Panther Wakanda Forever was better than this, so maybe I need to reevaluate whether I should have Guardians 1 above Black Panther. Wakanda Forever, not the first Black Panther,
yeah.
just Wakanda Forever. But I always felt that I bought into it more than you did, which is funny because with these movies, I don't feel like I buy in nearly as much as you. But I do think that this movie did do the best job of, like, establishing how much they need each other. And that was nice coming off of Quantumania, where there is no understanding of why these people need each other and their family members. Mm-hmm. They're family members, and, like, it's really, you're just butchering these characters for my entertainment, and I'm not entertained because you're butchering these characters. In this movie, it was, okay, we're actually going to work on building the depth of these characters. I will say, like, when I look at my ranking here, because now we're coming up on the Marvels, so I'm actually almost done and can actually say, like, I have a ranking. But when I look at this, like, the top 10 to 15 movies I have on here, I would watch again.
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah. once I get down below that I start to say, okay, that's enough. Like, Spider-Man Homecoming is kind of like the cutoff there, or it's like, would I watch this? Yeah, probably. Like, it's entertaining enough, whatever. But, like, I like the first two Ant-Man movies. I thought Ragnarok was, you know, good enough. Mm-hmm. So, like, I enjoyed all of the Guardians movies. And I think that's where, for me, I almost feel like I should watch all three of them just side by side to see how I like them, rather than watching all of this other nonsense and garbage throughout and seeing how their characters just randomly pop up in these other movies, where how much does it really do to progress the story? Because it does seem like with this movie, Disney and Marvel heard the complaints of, hey, like, you're losing the plot. And they said, mm-hmm. okay, we need to find a plot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was probably a lot of the James Gunn of it all too, though. And I think that's a lot of the reason why Warner Brothers was like, James Gunn, run our department now. Like, yeah. run all of our DC movies. We need you in charge because you do understand this through line. You get that, and you've demonstrated it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think James Gunn, like, I don't know what his tweets were, so I'm not going to comment on what his tweets were, but James Gunn has such a style. It's such a distinct style. It's such a unique style. Like, people know when a James Gunn movie is being made, whether it's mm-hmm. the Guardians movies, the Suicide Squad, which I know is not popular, but you still know. Slither, Super, like, you know when James Gunn is making movies. It's actually kind of crazy that he's only really made 7 movies. But I guess that's what happens when you spend so much of your time doing Guardians movies, because these are long processes. But you know his style, you know what it is. And I think people, again, I'm not going to comment on what he said because I don't know what he said, but I do think, like, can we get to the point where we're not hunting people down from 10 years ago to see what they tweeted or what they said? Like, well, will we ever get to that point?
That was the big thing that came out of this entire thing, was we have to acknowledge people can rehabilitate and change. And canceling people, it was really interesting because it was kind of at that, like, if I recall correctly, it was like the beginning of COVID, or maybe like right before COVID, that this all surfaced. So
yeah, I mean, because like that's the biggest thing, is it's like, let me see what he said. So here we have blah blah blah. I wouldn't have chosen to do none of them. I'm much, wait, no, that can't be it. Where are his, it was, oh, it was 2018.
That the tweets were,
that's a, yeah, that's a long time ago.
It is now, yeah.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. And I mean, it was a lot of like, I see, like, this is the thing. Like, as I read this, I'm like, this is literally just shock value tweets.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Like, this, I mean, are they ridiculous? Yeah, they're ridiculous, but it's like, these are shock value tweets. And I get Disney not wanting to be associated with them, but James Gunn isn't really the type of person you probably want to associate with. Go look at his two movies that came out before he started doing Guardians.
Yeah. Very true. Know.
Anyway, that's a sidetrack there. Mm-hmm. Overall, solid movie. I'm happy with the Guardians movies. People would always tell me, you'd like the Guardians movies. You'd like the Guardians movies. They're pretty much right. You know, I still, like, I'm not going to run. It's like when Guardians of the Galaxy Volumes 4 run, comes out, I'm not going to be sprinting to the movie theater to go see that movie. I'm not like, oh my God, I got to go buy a Star-Lord jacket. But it's not going to ever be like that. But yeah, they're entertaining movies. They are solid movies. I still think the Captain America movies are better. But these are solid movies with a good sense of humor. And it ends on it's ended on a very good note. It has ended on a very, very, very solid note. And it leaves you wanting more from these characters, which you can't always say when you come out of one of these movies.
True. How do you feel about Linda Cardellini becoming another person with multiple roles in the MCU?
Yeah, so who is Linda Cardellini in this movie?
She is Lila, the otter thing.
Oh, she plays the otter thing. See, that's where it was like, I knew she was in it and I was trying to listen, but I'm looking for the face. So she plays the otter thing. Yeah, and it doesn't really bother me. You want to use a voice. Because what else does she play?
She's Hawkeye's wife.
That's right. Maybe the otter thing got shot, but actually was rehabilitated and becomes human and becomes Hawkeye's wife.
But now that we're talking about these animals being shot, I think it's really interesting that they decide to go this way with Rocket's guilt over that.
Mm-hmm.
As they're shot, as he's trying to rescue them before they're executed. I think that's a really powerful moment for Rocket, especially like when he, you know, he's in the like pseudo afterlife aspect thing with the all white and everything. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, you can come with us, but not now. You have more stuff to do. It's just really interesting to like have him manifest that guilt of you died, but they were going to die anyways. And I think it's a really strong thing. Again, it goes into the entire message of like people dying and stuff. And I think that again plays into like the Peter Gamora stuff of it all, where there's a lot of guilt that these characters have over things that they couldn't have stopped, right? Like it wasn't like, oh, they died and they weren't going to die. It was they died trying to prevent themselves from dying.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like I liked the friends thing. Like that storyline didn't bother me. It was just so obvious where it was going the entire time. Like it was so obvious that they were just going to kill them all off. But I think that this is really good character development, because it also shows that when Rocket always says, I'm not a raccoon, I'm not a raccoon, I'm not a raccoon. And then we see in this that he is a raccoon, but really Rocket's not a raccoon. Rocket is become human in his emotions. And I think it really is showing that, you know, the guilt and all that, it's able to show that he is elevated above just being an animal. He's above just being a science experiment. Like there is more to him. And yeah, like you just said, you see those other emotions from the characters who are trying to protect him, who are human or alien like humans, whatever. And he's got all the same emotions as them. So when he says, I'm not a raccoon, he really isn't a raccoon. He's not.
Yeah. And even when, like, there's the comment, I think Sean Gunn says it towards the end, but I thought we were only saving the higher life forms.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like, is that point where, again, like, I mean, obviously there's a lot of like animals rights stuff with tangled up into the message of this movie and everything. But that's the point where it's like, yeah, but this is what Rocket wants. Like, we have to save these because they're going to die too. And like, we can't really be discriminating on who we decide to save.
Yeah.
That feels exactly like a superhero message to me.
Save them all. I could have saved more, right? I know that that's from Schindler's List, but still, you could have saved more. Like, that should be the mentality of all of it, not let's destroy this city and who cares who gets in the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, 100%. I completely agree with you. No, and like I said, I feel like this fight scene at the end has the most meaning of maybe any fight scene in the Marvel movies.
It's definitely up there.
Yeah. I don't have anything else left. Like I said, next week, there's still the potential, but I highly doubt it's going to happen. So just assume it's not with Twisters in the Marvels. John said he's going to see Twisters anyway. So if I get a chance to see it and I can find a time to podcast, maybe next Sunday or something, I would do it. But it's looking very unlikely that we're going to do that. And it looks like Twisters is going to get moved to the Patreon and probably be an August release. We do have Twister coming out. Well, tomorrow we have Phantom of the Paradise coming out, which is a weird freaking movie. You should check that movie out. And if you want to become a patron, $5. You can get our movie coverage every single week. Then we do Twister next week, then the Iron Giant, and then we're going to do Life Aquatic. But we might just keep moving Life Aquatic down, and maybe Twisters will go in that spot. Then maybe we'll do the Deadpools or something like that, assuming I actually can't figure out how to get this done. So if that is the case, there's two ways it's going to go. Either we're going to do Twisters and the Marvels next week, or in the more likely situation, we are going to be doing the Marvels and Deadpool and Wolverine the week of the 29th, which is the last week of August. That is much more likely to happen. That is much more likely to be the case. So at this point, just kind of assume that we're taking a week and then we're going to come back and do that movie. And then John and I are going to figure it out. We have a plan for like a podcast, you know, mid-August, something like that. But we're open to ideas if you have any about what you'd like to hear us do or what you'd like to see us jump to next. I think that you haven't seen that, I think, is a failed experiment. I'm not ashamed to admit when something's a failed experiment. I think that one was a failed experiment. We talked about how it didn't seem like it had enough reason. So you're not going to keep saying, oh, we got to go back, which is fair. Totally fair. So, that's pretty much where we stand on that. So we're trying to come up with another idea, something that's not going to force us to watch like 30 movies a week. It's like doing a bracket. The Adam Sandler bracket was probably our most successful thing. But I watched so many damn Adam Sandler movies that week. Like, I don't have the time to do that all the time. But maybe we could turn that into like a monthly podcast or something like that. Not about Adam Sandler, but just about things in general. So anyway, tune in, stay tuned. We'll figure out what we're going to do next. And that's it. That's all we got. Thank you all so much for listening. And we'll see you probably in 2 weeks.